from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. San Francisco may soon have close to 4,000 electric scooters traversing its streets, all part of the so-called mobility market that startups are capitalizing on. But while riders might be happy with improved scooter availability, other city residents are frustrated by bad behavior from reckless riders, driving too fast and with abandoned scooters littering sidewalks. We'll get the latest on the e-scooter market, and we'll hear about a new UCSF study finding that e-scooter accidents leading to hospital admissions went up 365% between 2014 and 2018, and that one in three injured scooter riders suffered a head injury. That's all next after this news. Welcome to this morning's Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. Approximately 3,200 electric scooters can be found zipping around San Francisco at any given time. And as the city continues to grow its fleet of zero-emission scooters, we'll get an update on their convenience, safety, and regulation. And we'll start by hearing about new research out of UC San Francisco into the prevalence of injuries while using e-scooters. Benjamin Breyer is Associate Professor of Urology and Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC San Francisco. He's also the main author of The Urban Health Scare, E-Scooters Show Alarming Spike in Injuries. Dr. Breyer, good to have you aboard. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin by what is most alarming about these spikes in injuries. I suppose we have to begin with head injuries, don't we?
Yeah, I think when one considers the injuries, it's not too surprising that there was a rise in injuries given that the prevalence of the scooters themselves increased and ridership increased, you know, dramatically when the scooters hit the street. But the thing that did pop out at us most was this issue of one in three ER visits related to a scooter trauma nationally had to do with a head injury.
And in fact, Consumer Report came out with a similar kind of alarming report, 1,545 accidents with electric scooters just over the past year. This seems to dovetail in a similar direction, but it's hard to really get hard data here, isn't it, in some respects? I mean, because you don't know who's wearing, for example, a helmet and who's not wearing a helmet. We just know that most people aren't wearing them.
Yeah, we have data that shows that people typically aren't wearing helmets. But for example, in our study, we don't know whether someone was wearing a helmet or not when they were injured.
So what else came out of the study that really the public should know about here, particularly in terms of injuries and what's to be alarmed about?
Yeah, I think the main thing is this issue of helmets and this issue of head traumas. The time will tell. I think we need more data on actual rider exposure. So how often are people riding and the miles ridden to see how safe scooters are versus not safe compared to other modes of active transport.
Were you able to determine safety as far as pedestrians or cars are concerned because of the, shall we say, ubiquity now of scooters?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do have concerns when scooters are not ridden properly. If they're ridden on the sidewalks, you worry about pedestrian injuries. But the data itself did not provide any information about any pedestrian versus scooter issues. You know, when I look at the data, the takeaway for me is I think scooters are here, and I think they're an important part of the active transport ecosystem. I think that scooters allow people to have an active commute. It'll probably lead to less traffic congestion. But I would like to see people ride their scooters more safely in terms of head protection.
And your data looked at e-scooters only, or were there other mobility devices like wheelchairs and kids scooters involved in the study?
No, we culled through, read through every single narrative and removed any kind of hoverboard, wheelchair, these kind of devices.
Well, I appreciate your spending this time with us, and I thank you for joining us. Can people look at the study online? Is it available?
Yeah, it's available. JAMA Surgery is the journal.
We'll put a link to our website so anybody can go and read it. And Benjamin Breyer, thank you again for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
It's Benjamin Breyer. He's Associate Professor of Urology and Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC San Francisco. Lead author of the study, again, which is Urban Health Scare. E-scooters show alarming spike in injuries. And what's your take on e-scooters? The future of transportation or a bane on city streets? You can give us a call now. We invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Laura Bliss is also joining us. She's transportation and infrastructure reporter with Bloomberg City Lab. Welcome, Laura Bliss. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And here with us in studio once again is Dan Brecke, editor and reporter with KQED News. Seeing a good deal of you, always a pleasure.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. I want to actually begin, if I may, with you, Dan, just in terms of scoping things out. The e-scooters are, again, into the whole environmental questions in the course of this hour, I know, but a lot of pedestrians are aggravated, and drivers and bikers. Cyclists angry about the use of bike lanes. Scooter riders blame cars mainly in the transportation infrastructure. But the fact is, they presented a lot of, formidable problems in terms of how and ways to regulate them, particularly when it comes to wearing helmets.
Well, you know, change is hard. This is something new. And just 2 years ago, if you had said, how about those e-scooters? Nobody would have known what you were talking about. That's all changed now. Listen, you know, I talked to Dr. Breyer myself earlier this week, and he, you know, talking about the helmet question in particular, you know, we were talking about scooter riders versus cyclists. Many more cyclists wear helmets. Now, not nearly all of them do, but say half, just, you know, use that as a baseline.
Sounds high.
Well, it's a lot. I mean,
in terms of the numbers that I've seen.
Well, I mean, here in San Francisco, we have cycling subcultures that may reject helmets for a number of reasons, from fashion to other sorts of statements, or just feeling like they're really not that effective. But I think, you know, it depends on where you go in the country. But I'm just sort of putting that number half out there. I think the actual numbers in surveys are lower than that. You're right. But when these studies, and there have been several other studies done on injuries associated with scooter use, you know, one in Austin, Texas, one in Southern California, and one that looked at several unidentified emergency trauma centers, you know, that is a common thread. There's a high number of head injuries, high proportion of head injuries, up to half in some of these studies. And people are just not wearing helmets. In the Austin study, one of 190 riders who had presented themselves in emergency rooms had been wearing a helmet at the time of their accident. Dr. Breyer was saying, well, there might be a cultural difference there. And that may be true. But there's also kind of people are getting a mixed signal about what's safe and what's not safe about the scooters. And probably in California, the biggest signal that maybe it's safe to ride without a helmet is the state passed a law, and Governor Brown signed it, a bill sponsored by Bird, one of the big scooter companies, to remove the helmet requirement for people 18 and over when riding an e-scooter. So it's a big hill to climb to convince people, you know, just based on even on careful statistical studies that, you know, is really smart to do, because they're hearing they're getting another signal from someplace else that it's OK to ride without.
Yeah. Let me talk to you, Laura Bliss, about the companies and what they've done, not only here in California, but they've certainly been working to make sure that helmet laws are seen perhaps as violations of freedom and don't need to be brought. And they've passed out a lot of helmets, given a lot of helmets away free. But the fact of the matter is there's a real disconnect here. You look at photographs that are essentially for mercantile marketing purposes on Instagram and all the rest of social media that those companies put up, and most of the riders don't have helmets.
Right. It's a really tricky needle to thread for these scooter companies, and I think you do see variation among different players in the industry. You know, I think Bird was particularly out in front with that law. There are other companies that have been, you know, big on pushing safety pledges, where, you know, you check a box and take a survey online and you get a helmet for free, and have added more language to their apps to encourage that. But it is tricky, right? Because they do want to promote this image of convenience and ease and the sort of simplicity of having this other option you can go to, you know, if you don't have your car out and about, which is kind of the, you know, equation that they're trying to write, this mode of convenience.
Let me bring a caller aboard here. And again, we do invite your calls. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Safety is a big concern. And I think, Ben, you want to address that. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question about the injury data. I was just wondering if of those injuries, if they'd had any idea of how many of those people were intoxicated or, you know, had a little bit too much to drink when riding the scooters.
You got a handle on any of that, Dan Brecky?
Yeah, in the UCSF study, it does not include data on alcohol intake. It's from a database that's part of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. So there's no alcohol data there. Some of these other studies have asked about alcohol intake, and it is a factor in some crashes. But, you know, just off the top of my head, the numbers I've seen were less than 10%.
And let me thank you for that call, Ben. We'll go right to another caller here. Let me go to you, John. John, you're on the air. Morning.
Hi. I think one thing that the public really needs to understand about these scooters is that they're inherently less safe than a bicycle. They're much easier to crash one on. I've ridden bicycles all my life, and we got some scooters for my kids years back, and I got on one, and I was shocked at how unstable that they really were. And so I think, you know, obviously people aren't wearing helmets on them as much as cyclists do, but the bottom line is they're just not as safe. You can't maneuver on them the way that you can on a bicycle. And I don't think a lot of people understand that.
John, thanks for bringing that to the public attention here. Let me go to you on this, Laura Bliss. Just how manageable and how maneuverable are they, in your judgment?
It's true. I think that there are a lot of ways that when you're on a, you know, standing electric boost device, number one, potentially going to be more likely to make risky decisions, like potentially checking your phone because your hands are freer than they are when you're on a bicycle. And, you know, especially in, let's say, the first year that they were out on the streets, like 2018, which now seems like so long ago, but really wasn't. They were much lighter weight and kind of felt a bit dinky, and there were a lot of issues with braking technology, and there were many stories about scooters just giving out, right, because the equipment itself wasn't quite up to speed. I do think we've seen a lot of the companies, thinking of Lyft and Lime and Spin, that have introduced, and perhaps all of them, I don't want to speak for all the companies, but that have introduced heavier weight models that add a sense of heft. And I think they're also, you know, looking at ways to sort of discourage riders from using their hands in other ways other than controlling them. I think there's this other really interesting dimension of who is riding the scooters. And we see disproportionately it's men, particularly white and Asian men. I think San Francisco has found that in its own city-based studies, as has Portland. Austin, I think we've seen the same, overwhelmingly male riders. And I think one of the reasons that researchers that I've spoken to cite for that is that women do identify these modes as being less safe than even a bicycle. And that's partly because, you know, it feels a little bit less protected, right? You just have less of a vehicle beneath your feet. And then this other really important dimension that we haven't touched on in the show yet, which I hope we do, is the lack of protected infrastructure. I think we've seen studies in a couple of cities now that do show, you know, scooter use is higher, and injury rates can even be lower in areas where there are protected bike lanes for scooter riders to use. On the other hand, you know, if you don't have that option, if you don't have a protected lane and you're maybe having to weave in between cars or even on the sidewalk and getting in the way of pedestrians or people using wheelchairs, right, you're just going to be in that much more of a risky position.
Laura Bliss is transportation and infrastructure reporter for Bloomberg City Lab, and she mentioned Portland, Dan Brecky. There was a Portland study. Injury rates, again, very high.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a common finding. But, you know, Dr. Breyer actually brought up a good point that we're sort of at the beginning of these statistical studies. So, for instance, there's not a lot of data on exactly what caused certain crashes, right? You may know that there were, you know, let's say 1,000 crashes, but you don't know exactly what the rider was doing, whether they hit a pothole, whether a car struck them, they got cut off by a bicycle, or were distracted by a cell phone, as Laura mentioned. You know, I mean, we're going to see sort of these top line numbers for a while. But as we go on in the next year or so, we're going to see much more precise data on exactly what's causing these crashes.
Well, we are going to go to more of your calls, and I want to read some of these emails. But let me go back to you, Laura Bliss, and just get, if we can, an overview from you about the environment, because for the most part, people celebrate the scooters as being good for the environment, less of a carbon imprint. But even that has had a good deal of controversy, and there's a real lot of concern about the problem of dead batteries. Can you address that?
Sure. Yeah, there was a really interesting report that came out, I think last year, maybe end of 2018, that looked at the life cycle of dockless electric scooters. I think it was using Louisville, which puts out pretty regular scooter trip data onto its public city web portals. And I think the reporter found that, on average, scooters were lasting something like a month. Like, that was how long the batteries were lasting. Or, you know, there may be other equipment issues that just kind of burn out after, you know, excessive use. And, you know, there's been subsequent academic research that's kind of done the comparison, like, okay, if that's the case, if that's like the average lifespan, well, how does the average carbon footprint of this particular mode choice compare to other modes, be it, you know, taking a personal vehicle, or, you know, a ride-hailing car, or a bus, or walking. Obviously, walking is always going to be the greenest choice, right? But I do think there was a study that found taking the bus was actually still a greener option than those scooters, based on those statistics.
Well, I want to get back. I'm sorry. Please finish.
Oh, sure, sure. Again, I think, you know, if we had a scooter company here, they would say, well, we're, you know, making huge improvements to the batteries, and, you know, storage life is not what it used to be, and every month we're coming out with something better. But I think Brian is right to point out that this is still early days. It's still a very nascent technology, and we just have a very limited set of information to really understand the role that this new mode plays in the overall transportation ecosystem, and again, kind of what it means when these companies say this is the greenest choice possible.
We need more research. I think you've just indicated that, and I would certainly confirm the necessity for more research. But we know we've got about 2 times the rate of head injuries of bicyclists, for example, and that is pretty alarming. There's also, Dan, let me go back to you, a lot of problems with abandoned scooters. I mean, whether it's the sidewalks or the street corners or the, for that matter, doorways, and a lot of near-miss collisions.
Well, you know, we're in a busy part of San Francisco, and it's common to see scooters on the sidewalks here. And sometimes when you very politely and gently call out to somebody that maybe they shouldn't be riding on the sidewalk, they will equally gently and calmly tell you that they don't really care what your opinion about that is. It's true that we have a lot of that in the city. I think in San Francisco, there's been a lot of progress made in not having scooters ditched everywhere. That has a lot to do with the fact the city requires them to have a leashing mechanism. So you actually have to connect them to something. Now, that doesn't completely solve the problem, because you can still leash a scooter in a place that's inconvenient or will block the sidewalk. But I think things are better. If you compare our situation with Los Angeles, for instance, a place I visit pretty often, their scooters are just dumped everywhere there by comparison. There are also a heck of a lot more scooters down there. And to just return to one point that Laura brought up, it's absolutely true that protected infrastructure, and we're talking about bike lanes that are really truly separated from motor vehicle traffic, do make a lot of difference. They make a lot of difference in terms of rider confidence and in safety. And I don't think there's any question about that. And San Francisco is making some significant investments in that kind of infrastructure.
San Francisco's had a pretty conservative approach, actually, overall, compared to other cities. And let me get Steve on here. Steve, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. Hi, I just want to say I've bought basically the Tesla of scooters, and I've been riding it to work. I crashed because I took my hand off the handlebar and it did a 90 degree, and I went down on the street, was wearing a full helmet, boots, thick jacket, thought I tore my ACL, went to Stanford, got an MRI. They said it's a big strain, but nonetheless, I still ride it because it's as fast as driving to work. I'm lucky I can drive down bike lanes and down like Santa Mosquino Creek where there's a dedicated bike lane. More of a comment, it's going to change transportation. We need to figure out how to make these safe. It's the most convenient way to get around.
Well, Steve, I thank you for that comment. Dan, you want to respond?
Well, if he's still on the line, I was going to ask him what his top speed is.
38.
Okay, and do you feel safe driving one of those 38, say on a bike in a bike lane or on a protected path?
There's nobody around, no other bicyclists or pedestrians. I'll have fun on it, but typically maybe 20.
Okay, yeah, just curious.
38's going pretty fast though. Thank you for that call, Steve. I'm going to read some comments coming in. A listener tweets: scooters are awesome, but sadly, I have found that they can be dangerous due to our own road conditions, potholes, and those yellow things with bumps are horrible hazards for scooters. Scooters are the most efficient motorized form of travel. And Billy tweets: when volumes of e-scooters increase, the likelihood of collisions increase, usually concentrated at poorly designed locations. The real discussion is how cities prioritize cars and street design and make walking, cycling, and scooting unsafe. And Sharon says, not surprised one bit about the concerns over head injuries and the like. Too many ride without helmets, zip too fast on sidewalks, and leave scooters haphazardly on sidewalks, creating trip and fall hazards. I'd like to see them banned. I don't know if there's necessarily a strong populist movement along those lines, but I was struck by a story. Dad, you probably know about the San Francisco City Attorney's Office. Just on Tuesday, they ordered a cease and desist to a rogue e-scooter company called GoX.
Yeah, those scooters, I guess, have been out on the street since May. And no, they're not permitted in the city. There are four firms here that are, and I'll see if I can remember them all: Scoot, Lime, Spin, and Lyft. Actually, no, that's wrong. Jump is the fourth one, and the GoX showed up on the streets, and they say their business model is to sort of make agreements with property owners like hotels to leave the scooters there. And the city's just not having it. So we'll see where that ends up. The city, as you pointed out, has had a very conservative approach. They've really tried to maintain control because of the Wild West atmosphere that surrounded the introduction of these things.
And we are coming up on a break. We'll take more of your calls when we return, talking with Dan Brecke of KQED News and Laura Bliss of Bloomberg City Lab. And just a tweet from Myra, who says, I ride a Vespa and took a course to learn how to drive it safely and watch out for other drivers. Then took my DMV test to get my motorcycle license. No one should get on a scooter and think it's the same as a bike. Maybe they will require licenses next, but here's another listener who tweets, why would you need a license for a device that goes slower and weighs less than a bike? We'll hear from more of you when we return. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Do you have questions or comments about e-scooters? If so, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. Number again for your calls, 866-733-6786. And you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. Benjamin Breyer was with us earlier talking about a UCSF study on the safety or lack of safety of scooters. Dan Brecke here with us in studio from KQED News. And Laura Bliss is also with us from Bloomberg City Lab. And Laura, I want to ask you, if I may, about something that came up right before we went to that break, and that is requiring licenses now for e-scooters. Talk about that in terms of the viability and really how realistic it is to move on that plane.
I can't say I know if there is there if in fact a movement towards scooter licensing. I'm not terribly familiar with that.
Well, we're getting some calls that suggest that maybe it should be in the works, even if it's not. Yeah, but you think it's a good idea on the whole? Is it necessary? Vital?
You know, I think that more, you know, safety training for anyone, you know, who's using a bicycle, who's using a scooter, who's using a skateboard. I mean, across the board, sure, I think there can be more, you know, effort on that level. But I do think, you know, I'd be remiss to not give some air to the folks in my Twitter mentions who, you know, as soon as the tweet ran out that this conversation was happening, there's folks in the bicycling and scooter advocacy world and just like, you know, transportation, transit, pedestrian advocacy world as well, that really want to point out, like, look at the vehicle, you know, crash and fatality rates, right? I think over half of severe injuries, let me actually look at my statistics here.
Well, they point to the cars mainly, don't they?
Yes, exactly. I mean, including it, you know, San Francisco, Zuckerberg, San Francisco General Hospital, right? Like something like half of the serious injuries that come through that hospital are related to vehicle crashes. So, you know, just putting the statistics about scooter safety in context with what else is going on the road, I think is really, really relevant. And so if we're talking about, you know, issuing driver's licenses to people who use scooters, like, okay, sure, but can we, you know, also maybe look at, you know, the overall picture? Are people who are driving their vehicles up to date on, you know, all the traffic safety laws that are out there? Do we have law enforcement who are enforcing the existing laws? And again, you know, going back to this point I made earlier, and that Dan also pointed to, you know, does the street infrastructure really support all these modes equitably? And I think right now, you know, save for a limited number of streets that have protected bike lanes and wide sidewalks, I think it's not hard to recognize that the streets really do prioritize, you know, serve and protect vehicles over all these other modes.
And I'm getting certainly a lot of response from listeners. Let me just read a couple of tweets before we go to one of your calls. JJ tweets, the fact that there's no helmet requirement is nuts. And Susan writes, you should be able to rent or buy a helmet from a possible vending machine. A QR code on the scooter could point to places to get helmets. And Scott tweets, if not wearing a helmet gets people out of cars and using scooters, it's worth the risk. If helmets are required, usage will go down and car trips will go up. Here's Everett. Everett, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Let me begin by saying that I'm all for these scooters. I think they're terrific form of personal transportation. But as an 80-year-old walker and pedestrian, I am livid about the fact that they're allowed to ride on the sidewalks. There actually is about 200 riding on the sidewalks, but I never see it enforced.
What about that question of enforcement on the sidewalks? It looms over this whole discussion, Dan Brecke.
You know, when you look at the local picture, it's I don't think I've ever seen anybody stopped and cited for this. You know, I don't know. I mean,
Can I just interrupt you for a minute? Because a comment just came in from a listener who says, we're all annoyed by scooters blocking sidewalks. So why not ticket scooters that are parked illegally? The scooter companies are in the business of innovation. If they were being ticketed when their products blocked the sidewalk, they'd innovate their way out of the problem.
Well, there are penalties, actually. They can't scooter companies can be cited for machines that block the sidewalk, and the city can pick them up and take them away, which is an expensive proposition for the companies. Now, that's here in San Francisco. Many other cities have parallel types of rules that they've imposed. But, you know, back to the enforcement part of this, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've been talking about San Francisco. There are lots of scooters in Oakland. You know, law enforcement has been given higher priority tasks, I think, than enforcing what's happening on the sidewalk, although every once in a while you hear about jaywalking citations. L.A. is a really very interesting laboratory for this because they have approved something like 30,000, 32,000 of these micro-mobility devices, both scooters, a kind of a sit-down scooter, and as well as shared bicycles. And the problem in L.A. is that it is The idea of taking one of these things on the street, even one of the shared bikes, which are kind of stout, you know, stable vehicles, it's terrifying. It's terrifying to think about going on the road where people are commonly driving 35, 40, 45 miles an hour. And, you know, there's only one thing in their mind, which is getting to wherever that place is that they, you know, they're working or shopping or whatever it is. And so I think, you know, in terms of how you enforce this, I think, you know, Laura and others have brought up something that's really important. We tend not to see the extent to which we have created a world that's for cars. And to really make things safe for everyone else, we have to change that. And we're seeing that in San Francisco. By the way, Market Street is going to close to private vehicles at the end of this month. And that's sort of a step that other cities have taken and could point the way to the future for safety for everybody using the street.
All right, I want to bring someone else into this discussion. And before I do, I want to just go back to you for a moment, Laura Bliss, if I may, with a quick question. I had brought up batteries before, and I'm looking at a question from a listener named Brendan who wants to know about scooter batteries and asks if they're really charged with 100% carbon-free fuel source. He says, I doubt it. Should we allow these companies to make the zero-emission claim?
It's a great question. Similarly, if you have an electric vehicle, it really depends on where you are, right? So if you live in the state of California, there's a much, much better chance that you're getting carbon-free, you know, solar-powered energy like pumped into that battery versus a state, let's say, you know, in the Southeast, for example, which has much, much heavier rates of reliance on fossil fuel-based electricity.
Well, it prompts me to bring in Juan Matute, who is deputy director of the UCLA Institute of Transportation Studies and who has looked at carbon imprint and has looked at questions of effects on the environment. Juan Matute, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin with that question with you and just have your sense on it.
Yeah. So the electricity required to power the devices only represents about 10% or less of the life cycle emissions associated. And so about half are actually due to manufacture and transport, usually from Asia. Because of the short life of the devices, that all of that energy and emissions that goes into manufacturing them and getting them here is amortized over 6 months or less. The companies are working on more durable devices that are designed to last 18 months or less, and that'll improve that. And then about 40% of the associated emissions are actually from the support vehicles that are taking the devices around for maintenance or for rebalancing so that there's sufficient devices available at the start of the day.
I'd also like to ask you, Juan Matute, about, well, I'm looking actually at a tweet from a listener named Laura who says, transportation ecosystem is aimed only at able-bodied young men as a nuisance for all other populations, women, parents, older people, disabled people, etc. That's more of a comment, but I know you've done studies on really what can be done about mobility-impaired riders. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, we have a student working with SFMTA and a local nonprofit that is Seniors Disability Action, who's doing a study now, a survey of San Francisco's senior and disabled population to better understand their needs for modified shared mobility devices. So they're just in the survey phase. That work is being done by Matty Ruvolo and will be published in July of this year. So still learning.
Well, we'll wait and see what you come up with. But there was a study last year about San Francisco's e-scooter market. What are the main takeaways from that?
Yeah, San Francisco is somewhat of an ideal market for planners thinking about how e-scooters can augment more sustainable transportation networks and for the companies involved. And so for planners, they're interested in scooters connecting with public transit. And 30% of scooter trips in the pilot period survey connected with transit for people who would otherwise have not taken transit. And scooters are primarily replacing vehicle trips in San Francisco, mostly Uber and Lyft trips. And so they are scooters and bikes are much lower emissions per mile than those devices in the operating phase.
Since you mentioned emissions, I'd also like your take on the carbon footprint of scooters, what we know and what we don't know?
Yeah, so again, it's the rebalancing. So it's not the trip that you see, it's the manufacture and the rebalancing of the scooters. And what we don't know and what we're collecting more information on is kind of the difference in business models. So some companies have been gig economy based, maybe until the law changed this year, but they send out people to basically scout for scooters, load them up in the back of the vehicle, and that's very inefficient. And then some companies have chosen to use, you know, electric cargo bikes that can be powered renewably for that operation, and that has a lot lower of an impact.
Wamatute, good to have you with us. Appreciate your being with us. Wamatute, again, is Deputy Director of the UCLA Institute of Transportation Studies. He joined us from Southern California. Let's have some more callers join us. And Kai, we go to you next in San Jose. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a couple of questions. The first is more with how scooters help to connect more suburban denizens, say, of San Jose and other South Bay cities. And the second is the price point. Just this morning, in fact, I took one of the electric Lime scooters from my apartment in San Jose over to the light rail, you know, running late, got to catch up with a train. And it cost me $2.75. I went maybe a tenth of a mile and rode for 5 minutes, you know, following the rules and all that. How does scooters help to really address mobility challenges within urban and suburban environments, especially considering A, they're not available anywhere in suburban areas, and B, they're getting really pricey?
Important questions. And Laura Bliss, let's go to you first on suburban areas, your take.
Sure. I think that we do see, you know, the most successful areas economically for scooter companies are going to be denser parts of the city, right, where it is more viable. You're already out walking around. You don't necessarily have a car parked somewhere already. And maybe you need to, you know, make a quick trip to the UPS store or to the restaurant where you're meeting your partner or whatever it may be, and you're taking the scooter, because it's a fairly short distance you need to go. In fact, there is research out there that suggests, you know, again, this is all early, but that most scooter trips are between 1 and 2 miles long, which is really, you know, the reason why we're seeing these scooters mostly displacing car trips, right? It's like a little bit further than you'd normally want to walk, but it's a nice option to have if you're not so that you don't necessarily have to drive. In the suburbs, right, that gets a little bit more difficult because you tend to have longer distances in between your house and wherever it is you might need to go. In that setting, I do think you see the scooter companies and also, you know, transportation researchers and city planners seeing this mode as more of a first and last mile option. And what that means is scooters as a kind of way to fill in the gap between you and the nearest public transit stop, right? So maybe you take the scooter that's, you know, a couple blocks away from you, ride it a mile and a half, which might be, you know, longer than some people are comfortable doing. But the idea being you take it to, you know, the light rail station or the bus line, which takes you where you need to go to your final destination.
And again, Laura Bliss is transportation and infrastructure reporter with Bloomberg City Lab. You want to talk about price, Dan Brecky?
Well, you know, the price structure is there's generally a flat rate that starts as soon as you rent the scooter, and then it's a per minute a fee on top of that. A tenth of a mile is 528 feet. I usually can't unhook the scooter fast enough to I will walk the tenth of a mile, to be honest. But, you know, about the price point and about the where the scooters are distributed, it's a very important point, especially in cities with disadvantaged, underserved communities in terms of public transit. And again, both San Francisco and Oakland have really tried to focus on getting the companies, as a condition of operating in the city, to distribute scooters rather evenly. So people who are not in those urban core areas where there are a lot of downtown riders have a chance to use them.
Let me read a few comments before we go to more of your calls. I thank Kai for that last call. Ben writes, I'd like to see scooters be required as inoperable in designated areas and at designated hours. I believe geofencing is the right term. And Chris says, not a good idea to mix e-scooters with cyclists and bike lanes. It's an issue I deal with when commuting by bike in San Francisco due to the increased speeds of e-scooters. Same applies to e-bikes, which are an even worse problem to deal with in bike lanes. And we go to more of your calls. Let me go next to you, Carol. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not opposed to surveys and research, but if you leave those things in the hands of these exploitative companies, you know what kind of a result you're going to get. It strikes me that what we have already is the clarity that these companies are interested in making money and they're not interested in safety. The idea that you could license the scooter drivers is pretty funny, considering that they ride on sidewalks and they don't wear helmets and they pay no attention to the rules anyway. This is a move fast and break rules culture that this whole thing came out of. And when the highly paid venture capitalist funded consultants walk into a politician's office, the politician does what they did in San Francisco, which is not a conservative approach. They just roll over and let them do whatever they want. And I'm speaking as a senior who has been collided with on the sidewalks by people coming at me at what doesn't sound like a fast-paced 20 miles an hour, but it's a serious issue. And I've had people break their hips. I'm a senior advocate who's seen people break their hips and not survive over the course of time, an injury that is just too debilitating to enable them to recover. I really think that these should be banned, and that instead of exploiting our public sidewalk, which we paid for, and skirting the ADA, which is a civil rights issue, we should invite them to make a scooter that is, number one, safe, number two, won't go without the wearing of a helmet, and three, won't function on a sidewalk. And that's all doable.
Carol, I thank you for the call. Dan Brecky, response from you to Carol's call.
Well, listen, those are all really serious concerns. I don't know about the technological feasibility of making a machine that will work on the street and not on the sidewalk.
You can do it. I know how.
There are scooter companies, right here in the Bay Area, headquartered here, that would probably like to hear from you.
Yeah, they would indeed.
This is a ubiquitous problem. And like I said, 20 miles an hour, that is a very serious matter. That's fast enough to be seriously injured, regardless of the mode of transportation that you're interacting with. And I can't do more myself than express some sympathy for that, for that view. And again, I suppose this raises the question of enforcement. And we're not seeing that kind of enforcement, I don't think, anywhere.
Yeah, Carol, I thank you for the call and appreciate hearing from you. And here's a question I'm going to go to you with, Laura Bliss, talking about how scooters are manufactured and the like in that last call. Abby asks, what happens to scooters when they stop working? Is there a closed-loop product cycle? Are they fixed and reused, or is it open, as in our old scooters thrown away?
That's a great question. I'm not aware of a serious scooter recycling program. I think we have all read stories about how recycling programs across the board are facing some serious challenges. Not only from the sort of consumer facing at the consumer level, but also for a number of industries due to trade policy changes with China. I think us in the transportation world will also remember these photos of dockless bikes and as well as scooters from China a few years ago at kind of the very beginning of the micromobility boom, let's say, where we just saw mountains and mountains of these disused vehicles just kind of piled up. So I'm not aware of any closed-loop recycling programs at this time.
Well, we will go to more calls. I want to read a comment first from Eric, who writes, I love scooters because I'm disabled and can't walk far. They really help me get around and do quick errands, go on quote-unquote walks with my wife, and have more freedom in general. And here's a listener. Joshua says, you haven't mentioned drunk or drug driving. Actually, we did briefly, but he says, while using scooters, they're outside of bars and likely seem like a safer alternative to driving a car while intoxicated. So we have some positive remarks from listeners there, and let's hear from more listeners by phone. Sean, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to just make a brief comment on sort of the lack of standardization between the scooters. For example, if you ride one, you might have to brake with your back foot and the front. And then another one might only use the brakes on the front. So if you go from one to another, it might brake totally differently. And it seems kind of unreasonable for someone that's just walking up to the thing and scanning it to, like, there should be some industry standardization for how these things handle. Also, they'll like start to stop themselves as you go downhill. I've found that to be kind of dangerous, actually. Like, it just starts braking, and you don't really expect it to do that while you're going down a hill.
Well, when you started your comment, Sean, Dan Brecky was nodding his head vigorously. Dan, weigh in.
Well, there is a learning curve when you get on one of these machines. You sort of have to learn what the protocol is there. I mean, it's not – if you get on a shared bike, the brakes, for instance, work the way any – you know, if you use handbrakes, the way any other bike would work. Your left hand stops the front wheel and your right hand stops the rear wheel. You know, used to be that the first generation of Lime scooters had a handbrake. The Skip scooters that were on the street for a while here had an electronic brake where there's a lever that operated it on the left hand. And you don't know the point about which wheel is being stopped is crucial. If you hit on any two-wheel vehicle, if you hit your front wheel too hard, then you're going to flip over. And that's been actually a big source of injuries.
Let me thank the caller and read a comment from a listener named Ira who says, we need etiquette for small electric vehicles. As a surfer and mountain biker, we have strong rules to who yields to whom, and they are for safety. A mountain biker must yield, for example, to horses and pedestrians. Are we talking maybe... I'm going to go with you on this, Laura Bliss, about something that may be a pipe dream here?
No, not necessarily. I do think it raises a really interesting point and makes me think of something else related to this conversation, which is scooter advocates, and active transit advocates and the scooter companies and people who really support these things kind of see the population of people who are starting to ride scooters and other, you know, quote unquote, micromobility vehicles as a chance to increase the, citizens in support of expanded bike lanes and expanded sidewalks and infrastructure for other forms of transportation other than driving, right? In other words, to grow the constituency of people who are willing to kind of advocate and vote and rally in support of these kinds of road changes, which would, you know, make streets safer for those users. But it's interesting. So far, you know, I'm not sure if there has been a lot of interfacing between, let's say, the traditional, you know, cycling community and users of some of these newer devices, at least in San Francisco, where I also live. I hope to see comments in Twitter correcting me on this, or maybe later on the show. But I do think that kind of community cohesion might be the first step, right, towards developing a certain you know, set of rules of the road or code of conduct that is sort of collectively agreed upon by all those road users.
Well, you mentioned all the Twitter followers that you speak to. Maybe you can enhance this and promote it, because I think it's a very good idea as much as it can be promoted. Here's a tweet from a listener who says e-scooter users experience a similar rate of injury to bicyclists. I think that's probably not the fact. In fact, bicyclists probably have a higher degree of injury, but the listener tweets, and a far lower rate of injury than car drivers. By helping to move people from cars to a safer mode of transportation, e-scooters have been shown to have the potential to reduce serious injuries. What about that, Dan Brecky?
Well, listen, I think there's a certain amount of common sense. If you get people out of their cars, if the volume of traffic changes, if you have measures in place to keep the speed of traffic down, and that kind of thing, then you could probably reduce the overall number of traffic related injuries and deaths. I think it's an open question comparing one mode. Comparing all these modes together, like we were saying earlier, I just don't think we have robust enough data. And you know, there's something called the Micromobility Coalition in Washington, D.C., that is was set up to lobby for companies like Lime and Uber, which owns Jump. And, you know, they point to the road toll we have, you know, 40,000, you know, motor vehicle related deaths per year, something in that neighborhood, and millions of injuries, between 2 and 4 million injuries, depending on how you define them. And there's no doubt that that is the, you know, the major public safety concern around, you know, common travel these days.
I'm going to bring you on, Nathan. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to an earlier comment regarding trying to use a phone while writing these. I have sort of figured out how to do it, but it's really determined. I mean, you have to have both hands on the handlebars at pretty much at all times in order to be able to get these things going. But there was a suggestion that I thought of, maybe, you know, there's like a little, you know, how to ride, you know, info thing that pops up a lot of times when you're getting on these for the first time. But maybe something like a quiz, like you have to watch a video or actually do some reading on how to properly do this now. You know, just for general stuff. And, you know, there's signs on the scooters that say don't ride on sidewalks and things like that. And, of course, people are going to be able to do pretty much anything. But, you know, just like when cars were first, you know, coming up, it was very disruptive. So, you know, I think that's just kind of where we're at as we, you know, figure out how to actually make this work overall.
Well, we'll let your final suggestion conclude this hour, and I thank you for it, and I thank all who called in this hour and emailed us and tweeted and so forth, and thank especially our guests, Benjamin Breyer, who was with us earlier, Dan Brecke, editor and reporter for KQED News, and Laura Bliss, transportation and infrastructure reporter for Bloomberg City Lab. Thanks for being a part of the opening hour of Forum. We do have another hour ahead. Kate Pickard is joining us. She's written a book all about breast cancer. That's next. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.